Hey, Ian.
Hey, Chiquita.
Do you remember slime?
I love slime. You know I love slime. Which slime?
Oh, yeah. No, the fun green goo stuff that they just like poured on kids and then on the night.
Nickelodeon slime. Yes. Love Nickelodeon slime. Big fan.
Yeah. I was thinking back to like all of the shows and stuff that I loved as a kid slash just like vegged out in front of as a kid. And I just noticed that there is this recurring theme.
I've been slimed! No one escapes the evil horn slime pit!
Batman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
That's great! Actual physical contact! Can you move?
Hey, you guys are just in time to catch a Slime Time Live marathon celebration we're going on.
Born and raised in toxic waste, Scum and his rat pack thrive on pollution and have declared war on the environment.
Is it always green?
Well, yeah, it usually is, but I guess it could be red.
And I realized that, like, there was an overwhelming majority of shows that had some underlying, like, slime theme or, like, ooze. And a lot of times it was, like, toxic ooze. I was even thinking, like, one of my favorite slash only VHS videos that I owned was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Secret of the Ooze.
Hey, guys, look! That's the canister that had the ooze!
That transformed us all.
And so I like wondered, like, how did this sort of icon, this symbol of industrial waste and affecting kids fighting geopolitical secret wars with flying rainbow men, how does that translate into this gooey stuff that people are just like letting their kids roll around the carpet with?
This is a good point, because kids these days seem to have a very different relationship with slime than we seem to have had. Slime seems to be a thing that lives on social media. It's bright and colorful, and it's full of glitter and other weird objects, and people make it themselves at home. And it's a really different relationship with goo than people older than us had, I think. Like, if you think things like the Blob, for example, back in the 1950s, you had this radiation nuclear war fallout and sludge and ooze and radioactive waste. That made a lot of sense to have because people were terrified of being nuked. So what we're talking about here is something that's appearing in different forms over the decades through pop culture. And every time it seems to be representing a different fear or anxiety in some way about how we feel about the environment, or maybe we don't feel or care about the environment at that certain time. So what is the secret of the ooze? That's what I want to know.
Let's go ask an adult.
Welcome to This Will Change Your Mind,
a show all about how other people have changed how you think about the world.
I am Rebecca Onion, and I'm a staff writer for Slate Magazine, Slate.com, and I live in Ohio in the United States. The Buckeye State. Actually, it sort of fits in with the slime theme. A buckeye is a piece of a tree, but in Ohio, we like to pay tribute to it by making it into a piece of candy. So it's like a chocolate with a delicious peanut butter center.
Cool. Wait, weird.
So it's like nature made into something like commercial and delicious.
Wow. Okay.
Really bad for you.
I want to go back to that. So you're tying slime into nature. What about like green goo is nature related? Like, it seems kind of uncanny to me.
Oh, I think it's totally uncanny. I mean, I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of the slime phenomenon to me, is that it's this thing that I would argue in kids' lives, that it's a place that might have been previously filled by stuff that comes from the outdoors that is now was filled by this kind of green goo. So I think that they're probably in 1920 or 1910, the feeling of being like a kid and being like, oh, I have my hands in something that's going to like horrify
like
my mother.
Dirt.
that would have been like dirt or like weird crap outside. And then later on, when you are interested in natural science or biology, and you realize like, oh, like the underneath of a log has like these colonies of little grubs here, and like that's really cool and interesting.
You're right, everything like decaying is slimy. That was one of the things I was thinking about when you're like, stick your hand in something gross. I was like, oh, just like a mildew like pool.
Yeah. Well, the thing that makes me a little bit sad about the way that kids are so interested in slime is that there's a mysteriousness to that feeling of being like, oh my God, how did this even get here? Like, and you're just like, what is this even? There's something sort of immediately legible or obvious about it in a way that nature slime really isn't immediately legible or obvious. It's like the toxic Avenger type green slime. Like, I was looking back at that because getting ready to talk to you guys, I was thinking about that again. I really liked the Troma movies when I was in middle school and high school because they're, for any listeners who might not know, it's this director, Lloyd Kaufman, who is really into sort of like gross out borderline horror comedy, but like super low budget, like super, super, super low budget. And he had slime in several of his movies, or like monsters that manifested as slime or slime that turned people into monsters. And there is something really like uncontainable and scary about that slime, but at the same time it's so gross that it's not scary. Like, it sort of walks the line between like horror and comedy.
Like Ghostbusters isn't actually like scary, but you know, it's creepy and it's kitschy, and you know, again, it's kind of like playing around with this dead thing or this unknown thing or this, you know, science fiction-y thing, you know, with the kind of technology involved. It's now thinking back on it, the 80s seems like a visually a really slimy time.
I mean, I was born in 1977, so I was however old, seven, at the time that this started to become like a real thing. So I was sort of in the prime age for it. And 80s kids culture is really like a flowering of very kid-specific narrative and approaches, partly because of the, well, at least in the United States, that was when Reagan kind of like deregulated children's TV, or like to sort of allow people to have these TV shows that were basically half hour commercials for toys. Yes. You guys remember like He-Man show and and like gummy bears and Transformers.
My Little Pony.
Biker Mice from Mars.
G.I. Joe. There's one for all of them. Every single one is just a toy. But it also is sort of like a, I mean, I don't want to say, you know, before the 80s, kids never had like crappy plastic toys, but there definitely was a flood of that kind of toy and that kind of the fact that each toy had a multimedia aspect to it. So in a way, I feel like slime and kids culture was like perfect, a perfect component of that in a way.
You mentioned Reagan's deregulation of this commercial space. It seemed like there are two different things at odds here. You have like the ultra consumerism of like, plop your kid zombie in front of the tube and like get them addicted to like wanting their parents to buy this product. And then we're also seeing a lot of like pro-environmental narratives, you know, with these good guys and the bad guys, even within that. So there's sensible weird tension right off the bat.
Right. I mean, I guess it depends on how effective you think that like environmentalism and kids culture in the 80s, maybe especially the early 90s, was. I mean, I'm kind of like a sourpuss about that stuff because I sort of feel like any time that you're getting like an environmental feeling from like an explicit message that's coming from above to you through a TV set, I don't know. I agree more with the environmental educators who would argue that the real way to teach environmental stewardship is to have kids be outside and they're environments right outside their houses. That's an argument that makes a lot of sense to me, that the Captain Planet model of environmental education, where it's about stuff that's happening sort of far away, and there's a moral to every story about environmental stewardship, will get people to sort of like agree with that fundamentally, but it's not as lasting of a teaching as kids being outside and having a lived experience in the outdoors. So in that way, I feel like slime is almost like perfect. Like, it's like a commercially, at least at that time, it was mostly commercially produced product that gives like some of the experience of messing around with nature and might be packaged in that way. But I mean, it's coming from a factory, at least in the 80s. Now there's all kinds of kids making it out of different chemical components, but
that sounds worse, you know, when we were doing it that way.
Well, and they're all making it for YouTube, which is a different aspect, and you know, that sort of like takes the whole mediated aspect of it one step further. But I don't know, I sound cranky about it. I feel like maybe you might feel more positive about its connections to environmentalism.
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that you were born in the late 70s. Ian and I were born in the late 80s, so we're kind of on either end of this period of time, and I wonder if by the time that you had matured into your adulthood, you were kind of seeing all these things play out and it had a different effect, whereas like we were very much captivated by Captain Planet's mohawk mullet.
I love Captain I love Captain Planet. I'm not ashamed to say. I thought he was
I thought he was hot, and I was really confused about it. I'm not afraid to admit it.
I think to bring it back to the kind of children's media stuff and also broader like pop culture at the time, when you look at things like Ghostbusters or even the Toxic Avenger, that idea of slime as being a way to teach environment, or like you can grasp it, it's intuitive to kids. That doesn't really explain why it was in TV shows to me, though. You know, it doesn't explain why it was in movies, because that's still to an extent kind of a passive way of understanding that the world is under threat.
Yeah, because like I don't think the Nickelodeon shows that had slime in them had an environmental message.
No.
Like I don't think that was the point. It just was like, oh, gross. So it seems like there may be sort of like a back and forth between the uses of slime that are not environmentally related at all and the ones that have an environmental theme. So it seems like the Nickelodeon ones is just like, it's transgressive and it's like very visually vivid. Like you can see right away. I think it's the Nickelodeon Awards, whatever it is, it's Teen Choice or Kids Choice or whatever, where they used to slime celebrities. So it'd be like Marky Mark with a bunch of slime up and down his body. So that is like the ultimate expression of it, where it's like, haha, like you're an adult and you had to like deal with this. Like, welcome to our world, kind of.
It's true, right? It became kind of a marker of kid territory.
Yeah.
Could we talk about where slime came from originally as a toy? I'm genuinely curious about the history of this stuff as a toy, because it must have come from somewhere. Like someone someday must have mixed a bunch of random crap together and realized they had something on their hands, quite literally.
The old mad scientist trope, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so the Dr. Seuss book Bartholomew and the Oobleck from 1949 features a bunch of slime that comes out of the sky. If you look up the book, there's a funny illustration of a guy running with like a bunch of slime flying off of him. And so the Oobleck is something that it sort of transgresses the peace of the kingdom and makes everyone crazy because it just gets everywhere and nobody can contain it. But that was not a physical toy. That was a character in a book. So the first slimings were on You Can't Do That on Television, which was a sketch comedy show. And that was when if you said, I don't know, on air, then you would get slimed.
High stakes. So,
yeah. Then probably the one that people knew better was Double Dare, which first aired in 86. And then there's a bunch of different Nickelodeon shows that had a ton of slime. And there were a bunch of different toy manufacturers in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that made slime. So I found out that Mattel was the first, but Nickelodeon licensed it later on. And Nickelodeon also sold GAC, which was... you guys ever feel that?
Yeah. I loved that consistency when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think I might have actually had GAC. There was a bunch of different plastic toys that would come with like a little package of slime with them. Nickelodeon also tried to sell like slime related other products. So they had a slime shampoo and they had slime ice pops. And for a while, Burger King had a slime dipping sauce, which is so gross. In the 80s and early 90s, we didn't really make it. Like, I don't remember ever doing Oobleck at summer camp or anything like that.
No.
And that's more of a today thing. Maybe you could really say that YouTube has made homemade slime more and more popular. That, like, social sharing aspect of it. Like, the ability to sort of, like, go back and forth and be like, I made this. I made this. I made this. Like, look at this crazy color. Or, like, look at this consistency or
something
whatever.
Something that I was thinking when you were talking about the ways that kids can take a thing like slime and then, like, transform it into something else and, like, how much sort of imaginative power is in that. And I wonder if maybe the ways that it's been used in culture has morphed to reflect our own sense of agency over almost in like overcoming these scary toxic things like,
yeah,
like, you know, environmentalism and all the things that were kind of going off the rails in the 70s and 80s. It was scary and it was ominous. And there's always the threat of something not being contained. And that was the kind of way that we saw slime portrayed. And then a certain point, something changes and the threat is removed from it by the time that it becomes the slime that we see in like Nickelodeon kids culture.
There's sort of a nuclear fear argument around it in a way. I mean, I think this idea that in the late 60s, early 70s, through the 80s, there was a lot of, oh my God, what are we doing to the environment? Like, I don't know if you guys have ever read John Brunner's The Sheep Look Up, which is like a really chilling and horrifying science fiction book from the 70s, or Philip Wiley's The End of the Dream. So those are 70s environmental scare fiction books where like it's off the rails scary. Like it's like there are worms coming out of the sea and no one knows where they came from. Or like,
Shut it down.
Or like where it's like there's kids who are swimming in a river and a nuclear reactor containment fails and all of the water that was cooling the reactor comes down the river and like boils them alive. So like stuff like that is like what that's how people were thinking. People were thinking like, oh, we don't even know what the risks are that we've created. Like, we don't even have a sense of it. You know, it could be anything, which is honestly the way that I feel about climate change now is like the same way where I'm like, we don't know what we're doing. Like, what the hell? Like, anything could happen. I feel like slime in a way is it's almost like it's scary and gross, but it's almost like a way to make those kinds of threats carnivalesque and funny in a way. I really think that in some ways, culturally, we're just really bad at managing that kind of fear in a way that's productive. And I think we continue to be bad at managing that kind of fear in a way that's productive. And I feel like slime is like an example of like the kind of weird bullshit ways we come up with to manage it that do nothing in the real world. Sorry, I'm such a bummer.
So I guess there's a pattern like Hollywood screenwriters see stuff in the news and they go, oh, that would make a good story. I mean, you had like the Toxic Avenger and some of the other stuff come later, like the Mutant Ninja Turtles. What was that show with the big dog and Shaggy?
Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, they had some episodes of Scooby-Doo.
They definitely did. Yeah, they definitely did.
I'm Charlie Cray. I'm with Greenpeace USA, business and political strategist. I spent about 10 years as a campaigner organizer working on hazardous waste issues like incineration, toxics in the Great Lakes, PVC plastic, and the whole suite of chlorinated organic chemicals.
So you were like a real life Captain Planet?
I would not claim that.
You know, Ian and I were talking a lot about how we've come to understand a lot of things about environmental messaging from our childhoods. And we grew up in the late 80s and early to mid 90s. And it was, you know, a period of time where in the media, especially children's media, there were so many examples of storylines and cartoons and things that involved sludge and toxic waste and slime. And so we wanted to talk to you because we wanted to figure out, like, is slime real? Like, what is the closest thing to slime in real science land?
Yeah, is there actually a glowing green barrels that were tipped into rivers at some point? Is that something that was actually happening?
There definitely was in the earlier 70s. The Cuyahoga River went on fire in Cleveland. You know, there were algal blooms from fertilizer runoff. Hazardous waste down Valley of the Drums near Louisville, Kentucky. You had Love Canal, Hooker Chemical, which later became Occidental. It buried hazardous waste and it started oozing into people's basements. Times Beach, Missouri, where a small waste disposal company took dioxin contaminated oil and sold it as a dust suppressant. Maybe someone's outside gardening and all of a sudden EPA pulls up into the truck and gets out of their truck in moon suits. And they ended up evacuating the entire community. You've got Morrisonville in what's called Cancer Alley down between Baton Rouge and Louisiana, where there's a high concentration of chemical plants. There was Stringfellow acid pits incidents in Southern California. Warren County, North Carolina was one of the more famous cases. In the African-American community, they found high levels of PCBs. Of course, hazardous waste disposal companies target low-income and minority communities and have for forever because they're less politically powerful. And then, you know, after all this pattern emerged, some members of Congress asked the government to start looking at this pattern. And the General Accounting Office, as it was known around the mid-80s, did a report where they estimated that there were something between 130 and 425,000 hazardous waste sites in the country.
That's a massive margin. Wow. That's probably a massive margin of error.
That's just the waste sites. That's not even counting the people that would be affected by hundreds and thousands fold.
You know, all of this comes with the growth of a chemical industry whose products are not well understood or well-regulated. Obviously, some of this popped up in the news media. Love Canal in particular became a national story because they committed high-level civil disobedience, took an EPA administrator hostage for a day, basically. That became national news.
Were people just not constantly terrified by all of this?
Well, a lot of this, the science didn't emerge in some of this, what I'm describing, until later. But I think, I don't know how terrified people were. It really depended who you were and where you lived and what knowledge you had. I mean, if you remember in the 50s and 60s, there were all these sci-fi films, Godzilla or stuff, that were sort of responses to the testing of nuclear weapons. And most kids, people who are elder now, remember practicing duck and cover drills in school. That was one of the things they did. And so in the 70s and 80s, turns out that people trying to kill us were right here in the form of...
the call is coming from inside. Hooker, yeah. You
know? So I don't think that they wanted people to think about this stuff very much. But it was, you know, it was there in the background.
And it keeps emerging and it keeps popping up. And as you were going through that laundry list of sites, I mean, I was thinking about Flint and what has happened mm-hmm. with their contamination there. And also going back to that underlying vulnerability for communities of color or low-income communities and the lack of political capital to do anything about it. Can you talk a little bit about what that process is like of defending one's community from this sort of evil villain that's all around us?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's usually the women in the community who see a pattern of health problems. What happens is usually they find that their elected representatives are not responsive and they have to organize themselves by themselves. And at this point, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of community groups that have formed on the local level and often network with each other to find their common challenges and organize politically. But, you know, there was a lot of very strong organizing in the 80s, leading in the 90s, 1990, if people Google it, I mean, the first People of Color Environmental Justice Summit was a historical moment where you had Native Americans and Latinos and Asian Pacific communities and African American activists all coming together to bond and network and find common ground and articulate principles. And they really challenged the national environmental groups that were predominantly white in their staff makeup to pay attention to those who, as one person put it, don't have the complexion for protection. So it's a very large movement with a very rich history.
So it sounds like a lot of saving the environment is a lot less like Captain Planet and a lot more like Aaron Brockovich. Maybe minus the crazy parts.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, Aaron Brockovich is a really good point. You know, you've got a lot of women who are, you know, just really strong and don't take no for an answer and will find a way to protect their families and communities.
So we've got all this YouTube glamour goo, but it's not actually doing anything or making any difference. And it's just cute. And we've really divorced ourselves from our actual relationship to the fear of very real environmental threats. And I think it's a really good reminder that sometimes you actually have to like get up and go into the world and like face bureaucrats in order to make change.
Mm. Yeah. Slime has represented a lot of different things over the last 50, 60 years. But consistently, it's represented some kind of environmental problem. And it turns out that the children's media that we were being fed, as much as we feel good about it and feel nostalgic about it, being that emotionally connected with something as a piece of culture is not the same as being influenced by it as an effective influencer of change, you know, something that's going to make people get up and do stuff.
If we've learned nothing from this first season, it's that the power is yours.
The power is ours.
Ours. Yeah, it's like that warm, fuzzy feeling you get at the end of the cartoons, but you're like, oh, it's real life.
Yeah, if you want that, there's an easy way to get that as an adult. Like, you don't have to watch old reruns of Captain Planet on YouTube. What you can do is go to your local environmental community group meeting and get your hands dirty.
You know, I just made a connection back to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 Secret of the Ooze.
Yeah.
I think it's actually the reason that I like wanted to become a journalist. I think I was obsessed with April.
She's the news reporter
character. And she was super good at her job. She was always having leads and like finding out stuff she wasn't supposed to. And then
she wore a kick-ass yellow jumpsuit.
Yes! Style goals, journalism goals, hangs out with turtle goals.
I don't know if we can promise people that they'll be able to do the turtle bit of that if they join a community activism group. But you never know.
Activism takes all forms.
Yeah. And as we come to the end of this first season of this show, we've explored in different ways how ideas can change the world. But something that I think unites all of them is that it's never just an idea on its own. It's always an idea combined with other work.
Yeah, I think we've been looking at the ways that our brain actually interacts with the interplay of society and the issues at hand, and how it's kind of this dance between how we cognitively process things, our like social behaviors, like within our communities and within our environments, and then how that actually, you know, relates to how messaging comes across. And slime was just one example of how a representation of a representation can kind of evolve over time and just filter in our subconscious and essentially affect and shape the attitudes that we have about very real stakes confronting us and our survival on this planet. So that's it. That's the end of the first season of This Will Change Your Mind.
I've been Ian Stebman.
And I've been Chiquita Pascal. And we hope you've enjoyed this first foray into unpacking how other people have changed your mind. We'll be back, and to find out when, check out our website, thiswillchangeyourmind.com, where there are also show notes and other info about all things ooze. Many thanks to Sarah Miles for producing this season, and also thanks to Rainforestation and Kingstux for the use of their music. Please leave us a review on iTunes if you've enjoyed what you've heard, or just stop people in the street and tell them about the show, because word of mouth is the best way to keep a show you like alive. I also just like to take people's phones and, you know, with consent, and just, you know, pop into their little podcatcher and just, you know, just subscribe them. You know, you're like, oh, like, what are you doing? And you're like, I'm making your life better. Boom.
Subscribe.
Anyway, thanks again for listening, and until we meet again, take care and stay away from toxic waste dumps.